Okay.
Well, speaking.
You're
pretty good attendance.
Middle of my bills down there.
It's not for lack of interest.
Okay, all right, thanks, Bill. Come back when you can. Okay, we're, McKinnon, what can we do for you today? Oh, the credit union bill. Where is it?
Here, you told me to review it before 3 p.m.
It was implied that.
I said 3 o'clock, didn't I?
It was implied that if we didn't review it, we were gonna get cut off or something.
Yeah, we need the credit union bill.
Frankly.
The hospital industry.
Do we have the? We're gonna report it out.
Oh, okay.
What are they doing with the university?
Oh, they were going to the university.
No, they can't get walk on ice.
Okay,
Well, Swanson told me he tried to find it in the budget.
Better go ask Miles.
I think he has to have a PCM number.
He's got to, if he's gonna qualify under the retirement system, he's gonna be in.
What they have to do is find that number and then write legislative intent. PCM number so and so is not funded.
Was this Hyatt?
Yeah.
They're gonna try to, you can try to cut him out completely.
There's some.
Boy, that's a big issue, I'll tell you. A number of people, I should tell you, they expressed their concern when they found out it was coming down to Juneau to let my representatives know that they thought that if Hyatt was kept on, it would be like a crime. So.
Well, you know, the university is at a low end of credibility now because of all the.
What I meant to say on the board day, and I really kicked myself for not saying it, was what I was trying to lead up to, and I forgot the whole point.
Did anybody have any problems with the draft on the credit union?
Let's not ask Julius.
Yes, I know Julius.
No, Joe, did you have any?
Well, as well as you can cover a 30-page bill, you know.
Yeah,
I didn't notice anything wrong.
Yeah.
Well, has anybody really gone through and checked it? Couldn't staff people do that?
Well, yeah, John and Joe went up with Ken Humphreys and they sat down.
Rick hasn't had a look to see all this stuff. If you want to move it out, I don't object to moving
no,
it out.
No, I don't know if Rex had a look at it or not.
He said somebody from his office had come by this afternoon to pick up a copy of it.
Yeah, I get, Wes Coiner came by and picked one up, didn't he?
He was going to, yeah.
I told him.
What do you want the committee to do? Comment on the changes?
Well, the only thing we were going to agree to do was to check and to see if there was anything that was not drafted the way the committee voted to have it drafted. And we voted on all the amendments. So the only question was, you know, did in the drafting process, did something get loused up?
Yeah, or did one of those birds stick
in? Yeah, as far as I could tell, I couldn't, everything looked kosher. We were pretty clear cut on our amendments.
I don't trust them, because you know they are made to put something in that
you
will want.
No.
But my distrust doesn't go far enough to where I could spend all night going through this piece by piece.
We had all our amendments written down, so it would have been kind of hard for them to go off the track.
Well, what are we improving?
Credit union. Representative Bankworth would protect me by doing line-by-line analysis.
Well, I did. And
you didn't get the CS over to Julius, did you? I mean, I don't want
anybody
to see it.
No, I'm
really
all right, the question is, does anybody have any problem with any of the, with the drafting of the committee substitute?
I looked through it, not carefully, saw nothing wrong. Are you satisfied, our person, John?
John says.
Is John satisfied? Is Joe satisfied?
Well, as you can be without going through line by line. Right? I saw the major points that were brought up appear to be there.
You want to know if Julius is satisfied?
No.
Okay.
How about the definition?
Miles, you can explain.
Yeah,
if you want to leave.
What's the possible addition to the definition?
Ken Humphrey suggested we may want to include a definition of credit union building or corporation. He said he wasn't. Not sure whether or not it's necessary, so in case we did, it's survivable.
Do you think one is needed?
Yeah. No idea.
Okay, we'll study that and look at it when it comes on the floor.
Why don't we just hold it as a, as, that's great, you can have one amendment hiding in your head, you know, and then Urien stands up grandiosely or something like that, or one of our own caucus guys who isn't wired in stands up and
What is a credit union building corporation? And you omnisciently stand up. I just happen to have an amendment to cover that question.
Well, I move we move the bill out.
Is there any discussion on any discussion on the motion?
Well, I think I'll object to it. Just for
objection.
Too.
Okay. Objection is noted from the non-conciliatory member. All right. All those in favor of moving the bill out of committee, raise your right hand. All those opposed, same sign. You got 2.5 votes against. Okay. Just come by.
I'm sorry I'm late, Mr. Chairman. I was conferring with what the press calls high officials in the Hammond administration.
All right.
You got the press to go along with you?
Mm-hmm. No, I just practice my radio voice every so often.
We'll see you when they make the movie.
Yeah.
They're going to do a movie on this.
Our Reader's Digest condenses.
All on the floor?
I was going to ask you if you think that.
There'd be lots of changes on
that. All right, page 41, part 2, tentative drafts. Down on line 17, justification use of physical force by a peace officer in making an arrest or preventing an escape. Everybody got that? 41.
Okay. Yesterday I hit briefly on this, pointing out that under existing law, the literal reading of the statute requires that the officer be correct in his assessment of whether the individual has committed a felony before a homicide would be justifiable. This provision, like all other provisions in this section, is based upon a reasonable belief by the officer. Provides that the officer may always use physical force in making an arrest when it's necessary, that he does not have to retreat in efforts of making an arrest or preventing an escape. The real issue is not when physical force can be used in terms of non-deadly physical force, but really when deadly physical force can be used. And under existing law, a peace officer may, a homicide is justifiable when it's committed in arresting a person that has committed a felony. This is on page 41.
Page 41.
Well, now we're on 42, line 3. Line 3 and 4, I believe. I can't really tell which one. Line 4, I guess. Okay. And so the issue is, when is a peace officer justified using deadly force in making an arrest? And in looking at this issue, you have to consider that the distinction between felonies and misdemeanors as the dividing line and when an officer can make an arrest is based on common law. And in common law, there were very few felonies, and the very few felonies that existed all involved serious threat of harm to the victim and were punishable by death. And as a consequence, it did not seem particularly harsh to allow the officer to use deadly physical force in arresting for any felony. Now, in considering this section, we considered the state trooper's manual, and I think also the Anchorage Police Department manual in terms of when deadly physical force can be used. And according to the manual and the state trooper regulations, the use of deadly physical force is only in the last resort, basically. I mean, in terms of, it doesn't, it says that if any force other than deadly physical force can be used, you should use it. And we provide in the code that deadly physical force can be used in three situations. Subsection A, line 6, is when the person has committed a felony involving the use of physical force against the person. So it's not any felony. It has to be a felony involving physical force. What we've eliminated, of course, is the situation of using force, deadly physical force, to arrest someone that has committed a nonviolent felony, such as theft. Not theft from the person now, just theft or embezzlement. That is correct. That is correct. Unless it falls under one of the other two situations, B and C. And B is, I should point out, in this regard, this is a very timely issue because the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals just considered a statute identical to the Alaskan statute, which says you can use deadly physical force to make an arrest for any felony. And without distinctions between whether it was a violent felony. And the court held that that statute was unconstitutional as it deprived people of due process of law. And they held that life is a fundamental right and that using deadly physical force to arrest someone who did not pose an immediate danger to society in terms of physical injury could not be justified. Now, I'm sure this will go up to the Supreme Court, but there is at least very strong constitutional doubts as to whether you can automatically give the police officers blanket authority to use deadly physical force when the defendant has committed any felony. We have a lot of felonies in this code, and not all of them involve threat to the victim.
Should an officer be justified in using deadly physical force if the felony involved is fraudulent use of a credit card? The guy is not at all resisting arrest.
Yeah, I mean, your question, of course, is that in certain circumstances, the monetary loss could make the crime particularly serious, I think. A bank robbery, that would be a violent crime. There wouldn't be a problem with that. I mean, it's assuming that the robbery was... Okay. Section B...
May I ask a question about your...
With Missouri? Sure. Section B expands existing law in terms of giving an officer the right to use deadly physical force, and it says that the officer may use deadly physical force to make an arrest for any crime, not just a felony. It could be with a misdemeanor, if the person is escaping while in possession of a deadly weapon. So if the officer has reason to believe that the person has a deadly weapon, even if he has committed a misdemeanor, he may use deadly physical force to make the arrest. We were talking about yesterday how these defenses overlap, and when the person is firing back at the officer, it really isn't using force in making an arrest here. It's using force in self-defense, and that's recognized on line 2. The deadly force is authorized under other sections of this chapter, specifically self-defense.
If you're firing back, then
it's...
If he's holding the Tommy guy's hand, he blocks his way, kind of looking over his shoulder in case he's
right. Well, no, under this... Not under this. This is specifically providing that if the person is in possession of a weapon, even if he's not using it against the officer, and has reason to believe he's committed a crime, you may use deadly physical force. And I see that as an extension of existing law in terms of granting authority to the police officer to use deadly physical force.
If he reasonably believes that the person had a weapon.
Yes. Yes. Even if it turned out that he didn't have a weapon. This does not require that you have to expect he's going to use it. Well, he's also probably committed a violent felony under age. Yeah. When we were discussing this, the police, Colonel Wellington was saying that it's very rare that you're ever going to use deadly physical force against a person unless... But the current standards we have don't, number one, they require that the officer be correct. If a felony wasn't committed, it appears under existing law not to be justified in using deadly physical force, but it requires that a felony be committed. All we require is a reasonable belief that a felony is committed. But the commission, I think, wanted to, in one hand, limit the use of force in circumstances where, in fact, the officer is not using it, and that is the case of theft, the case of a fleeing embezzler. And on the other hand, give the officers authority to respond to the specifics of the situation. And that's really in Section C here, which is really a very open clause there. And it says, may otherwise endanger life or inflict serious physical injury unless arrested without delay.
I think it's getting a taxes we control that is getting on to the property rear of authority to make the judgment in changes to I think eliminating situations that will never occur. For example, sellers no one wanted that authority.
Yeah,
hope to, you know, I suspect by the time the other people provides personal assistance time with the
gangbusters when you were a kid and all that stuff. You get an entirely different attitude toward the criminal law than is really the truth. The interesting thing that I found about most of the criminals I have known that I knew to be criminals because of my position with regard to them was that except for the particular defect in their personality or their attitude or whatever that caused them to commit that crime or even a repeated series of those particular crimes, for other purposes, they're really rather interesting, likable people. So just on some of them, but on some of them, you just don't want to turn your back on them for very long. And
you find that particularly good prostitutes.
Oh yeah, very much.
Some of my best friends are prostitutes. I mean, I say, well, that's a bad thing. I mean, some of the ladies that I've known and
yeah, very personal
like stuff. Other than that one little thing, there yeah. Some of them are good mothers. Some of them are real nice people, but they've got that hang up.
There's one guy I know who's. One guy I know who's an inveterate thief. I mean, I can't believe that he's ever going to be doing anything that does not involve at least considering obtaining somebody else's property by any means necessary because he wants it. And yet, otherwise, the most charming guy you ever met. You know, but you don't turn your back on him. You know, don't leave your wallet around.
Well, you've known some of the bandit guys. I'm not going to name them here.
I know who they are.
And most personable, and yet turn right around and go out and do the most.
Some of them would rather not make it a speech because some of them ought to beat them.
Yeah.
Well, you remember how personal Ray Wright was.
We just started. I'm just explaining some stuff. We went over it. But okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. We're back on the record. And Mr. Gardner is back.
Thank you.
I'm glad you got back.
Give you my regrets in that. Wow. Must have.
Mr. Stern was in the middle of answering the question as to what changes had been made from what was thought to be current law in the section on attempts.
Well, yeah.
Tape recorder.
There will be as many here as there were before he came.
Yeah, I think it's important to consider these in light of the judge's comments that it's a defense code, because I think at least in here, I'll show you three examples where I think we made it a lot easier for the prosecution. An attempt, as I was saying, is required to show under existing law that you were unsuccessful in your attempt. So you have the rape situation where you can't prove that there was penetration. So you can't go for rape because there's a reasonable doubt as to whether the crime was committed. So you go for attempted rape. Well, there's a reasonable doubt as to whether there was penetration, and hence you haven't proved that the attempt has been unsuccessful. So you may be in a situation where, because of the requirement that you have to prove that the attempt failed, you may not be able to get a conviction for either attempt or the actual crime. And we just say, you know, there's no requirement that the attempt fail under the code. So it makes it easier for the prosecution
here. Well, what about a double jeopardy situation? That is, somebody's, you attempted it and you succeeded, so I'm going to charge you with attempted robbery and with robbery.
Okay, there's a section here that's reserved. You can see there are three sections here that are reserved: conspiracy, defenses to solicitation, conspiracy, and multiple convictions barred. Multiple convictions barred will provide that you could charge him for either one, but you could only get convictions for one of them. You can't be guilty of both the attempt and the crime.
Would you make sure that your notes show that concern was raised here
sure.
in the committee?
Yeah, I mean,
the double jeopardy problem between an attempt and the perfect, the perfected crime, not perfect crime.
The second change, the loophole that we're closing is in Section B. And that says, in a prosecution under A of this section, is not a defense that it was factually or legally, it's on line 11, factually or legally impossible to commit the crime, which was the object of the attempt, when the conduct engaged in by the defendant would be a crime had the circumstances been as he believed them to be. Okay, there are two kinds of impossibility when you're dealing with attempt. One is factual and one is legal. And the distinctions between the two are pretty difficult, but our Supreme Court has already held that factual impossibility is not a defense to attempt. And the situation was a case called Gargan. And in that case, the person...
Gargan.
Yeah. And in that case, the guy was breaking into a coin machine box on a laundry machine. And he said, I can't be guilty of attempted larceny because there's no money in the machine. He was saying it was factually impossible for me to commit the crime. He had to have an appeal over this. And the Supreme Court said, hey, buddy, that's not a defense. You're going to jail. It's no defense that the money wasn't there. And
what's the example of a legal impossibility?
Legal impossibility is you receive stolen goods. Okay. guy comes up to you on the street and says, hey, buddy, I've got some stolen goods for you. And you say, great. He gives them to you, and it turns out they're not stolen. It turns out that he just got them really cheap or something like that.
Well, that's rather silly, isn't it? You're going to prosecute him for attempting to receive stolen goods that weren't stolen. You're really punishing him for a bad thought that harmed no one, then.
Well, I think that the commission concluded in those circumstances where the person thinks he's committing a crime and he's done an act towards the crime, he's manifested his dangerousness, and you should be guilty of the attempt.
I agree. I can see you're up to. It's kind of like the guy that goes up and buys the car and you find out that it was sugar or something else. You know, that would fall just in that. But
yeah.
How would you like to buy the car? And he says, sure. If you pay him $1,000 for it, it later turns out to be powdered sugar. I still think.
I gave you the bad example, I think. The better example is the fact that sometimes you have these cases with stolen property and the police get the goods and then they sell to someone else to get someone else in, someone that's a fence for it. And they already, it's not stolen goods anymore because it's been returned to the police and that would get the fence. Not all jurisdictions recognize that factual impossibility is not a defense, but the commission considered that it should not be a defense. So we've eliminated, you know, potential appeal, and also we've made it, I guess, easier to prove it.
Mr. Chairman, I know we were trying to do a quickie run through on these things, but attempt, solicitation, and conspiracy, the inchoate crimes are very complex problems, and I hope we're going to...
We don't have conspiracy.
We're losing people. Are you going to have one?
We don't have it now. I mean, we don't have it now in terms of this book. As to conspiracy, they haven't had a final vote on it, but I think there's a chance there'll be a limited.
He's coming back, his glasses are there.